I'm asked, what is the relation between knowing God and loving God? Which comes first? Or do they go hand in hand? In Scripture, the vocabulary of knowing is linked with the idea of loving. You know the persons or the realities that you love. You have to say the two ideas are so closely related in Scripture that they can't be separated. It works like this. You must know about God in order to know Him. You don't know Him until, in some real sense, you are opening your heart to Him in love. Loving Him is the moral condition of knowing more. There are moral conditions as well as intellectual conditions of coming to know more. The basic moral condition is that you are responding to what you know already. Knowing on its intellectual side comes through taking note of what's said in Scripture. But you can stop short at knowing ideas about God. Knowing Him is a matter of entering into a relationship with Him on the basis of the ideas which you've come to know. If you're not open to receiving new truth from God on the basis of which He calls for a new response, well, the process of increasing in the knowledge of God can be stopped at just that point. I hope that makes it clear. The two things are simply inseparable. Let me say one negative thing in order to hammer the point home. It is possible to know all about God and not know Him at all. It's possible to know all about God and not be prepared to love God at all. If you're not prepared to learn to love Him, then you certainly will never come to know Him. It's the difference between the notional and the relational. Okay, we mustn't pursue that any further. Second question. Now, the question I've been asked, I think, is a misstatement of what I... No, it isn't. The question arises from what I said about both the victorious life view and the Wesleyan holiness view. I put them together and I said, so the questioner reminds me, that I would ask folk who claim to be living in this experience... one or two questions. When I said one or two questions, I didn't mean exactly two, neither more nor less. As again, the way the questioner puts it suggests, maybe I didn't say it very clearly. But the question that I would put to the Wesleyan person, may I start with him, please? The question I put to the Wesleyan person has to do with motives. I would say to him, don't you ever find wrong desires in your heart? Where do you think they come from if sin has been rooted out of your nature? That question, I think, will floor him. I mean, we'll show him that there's something unrealistic about the line that he's taking. And if it's a victorious life person I'm talking to, I shall ask him about his belief that he's being kept free from all known sin. I'll tell him the New Testament doctrine of good works. To be good, the substance of the action has got to be right. The motive of the action has got to be right. And the attitude of the agent has got to be right. And I would say to him, are you really telling me that every time you do anything, your motive is consciously and wholeheartedly the glory of God? Are you telling me that you never have to look back on any of the things that you do and regretfully acknowledge that it could have been done better? Or are you telling me that you believe that everything could have been done as perfectly as Jesus would have done it, let's put it that way, if your consecration to God had been more complete? And I shall press questions like that. And try by pressing them to show that this idea of perfect actions as the result of the work of God in a perfectly surrendered heart is a will-o'-the-wisp. Nothing that we do is absolutely perfect. and I would take them then to the second half of Romans 7, as I should be taking you all tomorrow morning, and I should try to show them that they can't face the second half of Romans 7, that is, that it simply doesn't fit with what they're saying. Some of them have a way of sweeping the second half of Romans 7 aside by saying, well, that's only the picture of a Christian who, because he's relying on his own strength, is in a spiritually unhealthy state. And you get out of that when you get into Romans 8. If they say that to me, I say to them, now, don't play games with me. Paul is talking about himself, I, in the present tense. What sort of a communicator was he to talk about himself in the present tense and expect his readers to suppose that he's talking about somebody other than himself at some time other than the present? That's not the way to use words. We use words in order to have our meaning understood. No, Paul meant he was talking about himself in the present tense at the time of writing in all those things that he says in the second half of Romans 7. And I would link with that Galatians 5:17 or 18, is it? The flesh lusts against the spirit and the spirit against the flesh. This is the condition of the Christian life. There are these two contrary sorts of urge operating within our souls. So that, says Paul, you cannot do the things that you would. Reach exceeds grasp. You may purpose perfection, but you don't achieve it. Well, I might even get to the point of saying, do you think Paul was wrong when he said that? That's the sort of questioning I would do with them. It sounds sharp, I suppose, but my purpose in talking about these mistaken views, let me say again, is not simply to be censorious. I know from my own experience, and perhaps there are others in this church who also know from their own experience, that if you take up with unrealistic expectations in your own Christian life, you are going to have an awful time. Because you'll never achieve them, of course. Or rather, let me put it this way. Either you'll have to acknowledge in honesty that you don't achieve them, or else you will have to practice deluding yourself by supposing that you do achieve them. Which of those two states would I rather be in? Well, of course, the answer is neither. They're both of them miserable states to be in. And I just want to save as many Christians as I can from getting caught up in that kind of bind. Mustn't take that any further, but I hope you get the general idea from what I'm saying. Any questions that will show the unrealism of what's going on? Oh, let me tell you a story. You'll like stories. Human nature does like stories. Spurgeon somewhere says that a man came to him and said, Mr. Spurgeon, I want you to know that I've been sinlessly perfect for the last 2 months. And Spurgeon said, I was most intrigued and I wanted to find out more about this wonderful perfection, his phrase. So he said, I lunged forward and stepped heavily on his toe. And and says Spurgeon, his perfection vanished as the morning dew. Next question. Next question. Yes, sir. Now, wait a minute. Question for the tape. I must repeat it. I've been asked to cite one or two verses of Scripture to bear out what I said about the connection between a man's holiness and his life. Sorry, a man's holiness and his usefulness. That's what I'm trying to say. It's difficult to prove this point by citing verses. I would rather prove it by pointing to the realities of ministry. The heart of ministry is love. Is anybody going to question that? If they do, I would turn them to Romans chapter 12, where Paul starts talking about the use of spiritual gifts, having gifts that differ according to the grace given to us. Let us use them, he says, verse 6. And then he starts a passage which very soon is talking about the most general forms of ministering love, showing that for Paul, gifts of ministry are, in fact, love in action. You see how it goes. Latter part of verse 6, Romans 12. If our gift is prophecy, well, let's do that. If service, now service is the Greek word diakonia, it means putting yourself at the other person's disposal to meet their needs, as a house slave does. It's a word which, prior to the coming of Christianity, was just applied to the service of house slaves. Well, putting yourself at the other person's disposal to meet their needs is an exercise of love. Then Paul gets back, second half of verse 7, to teaching and then exhorting. And then he comes back to the graces of Christian character expressed in the things we do. Give with liberality. If you give aid, do it with zeal. Now, one of the expressions of holiness is concern for the welfare of other people. It will give you the zeal for God's glory and their good that will prompt you to give aid aid in the way that Paul is describing. Next phrase, something similar. He who does acts of mercy, let him do it with cheerfulness. Doing acts of mercy is an expression of Christian holiness. I'm saying it backwards. Doing acts of mercy is a form of ministry, says Paul. He's introduced all this by talking about using spiritual gifts. But you're to do it with cheerfulness. That's an expression of your holiness, your joy in God, and your concern for the well-being of the other person. You won't do it grudgingly, as if they were dirt and as if it was a rather scandalous and shocking thing that God should be asking you to spend your time ministering to them. And then it goes on explicitly, let love be genuine. And this is a passage that deals with the use of spiritual gifts. Let love be genuine, verse 9. Love one another with brotherly affection. Outdo one another in showing honor, verse 10. Then never flag in zeal, be aglow in the spirit, and so on. Verse 14, I'm not sure that we are entirely out of the realm of ministry yet. Bless those who persecute you. Bless and don't curse them. Rejoice with those who rejoice. Weep with those who weep, and so on. It's passages like that that convince me that much ministry, most ministry even, is an exercise of the graces of Christian character. We tend to have too narrow a view about gifts and ministry. We limit gifts to gifts of speech. And we limit ministry to doing the sort of thing that I'm doing tonight. Monologuing, preaching, teaching, instructing, whatever. But in Scripture, there are gifts of Samaritanship, gifts of service, as well as gifts of speech. And when one reads what is said about the use of those gifts of service in ministry, well, one realizes this is love in action. But love to God and man, is the very center of true holiness, right? Thus I establish the connection. But I can't for the moment think of any scripture which lays it down in either positive or negative terms just like that. And there's a reason, I think, why this is so. The Bible writers never forget that God is infinitely gracious, and in particular cases, he can do a tremendous amount and will allow himself to do a tremendous amount through the ministry of folk who in private life are not holy persons at all. You've got that illustrated in the life of Samson. I talked about Samson earlier. Well, in terms of personal morality, Samson was a pretty sad case. But yet God used him. God used him to deliver the people from the Philistines. He judged Israel 20 years. He was a national hero. Because God does that kind of thing, one cannot say that in any particular case a man's ministry is going to be less blessed because there are things wrong with his private life. God may, do the exceptional thing, as he did in the case of Samson. But nonetheless, as a general rule, if we want to be useful, we should take to heart everything that's in Romans 12 about consecration, commitment, sanctity, and love. Okay?
Dr. Johnson.